Welcome to the Divorce Chronicles, a forum for insightful and practical information for anyone at every stage of the divorce process. Now, here's your host, Tracy Coates.
Well, hello there, and welcome back to another episode of the Divorce Chronicles. I'm your host, Tracy Coates. So for those of you who are joining me when this episode goes live in March of 2019, we recently, over the weekend, just sprung our clocks ahead 1 hour. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I always struggle days afterwards to get my body in sync and sort of get used to only that 60-minute change. You would have thought that we set our clocks ahead like 3 hours. I'm still struggling sort of day to day. But enough about me and my issues for today. I want to, before we get started on today's episode, turn to a little housekeeping and remind everyone that there are two really great free resources for you to download. The first being one that I created entitled 10 Mistakes to Avoid During the Divorce Process, which are great tips and suggestions for anyone at any stage of the divorce process. If you're just starting out and want to make sure that you stay clear of some of these pitfalls, or even if you're already in the midst of everything, it would be a really great idea, especially if you're struggling in certain areas and want some helpful tips as to how to smooth things out, then this download is perfect for you as well. Again, you can find this on my website, right on my homepage at www.thedivorcechronicles.com, or you can also find it at www.thedivorcechronicles.com/checklist. So check that out. The other really valuable resource that I want to make sure that you have is the post-divorce financial checklist, which comes from, if you haven't already had an opportunity to listen to, episode number 11 of my interview with wealth manager Heather Locus, where she shares really valuable insight about post-divorce financial issues that everybody needs to be mindful of before closing out this chapter in your life. Heather created a detailed checklist to share with all of you, and that can be found either in the show notes on my website at www.thedivorcechronicles.com or www.thedivorcechronicles.com/11. So check out those free valuable resources. I want to make sure that everybody has as much information to help them along this process as possible. So don't miss out. Now that we've gotten a little housekeeping out of the way, I'm looking forward to sharing today's episode with you with my guest, Eric Rollinger. As you may recall, in episode 9, we'll call it a mini tutorial, where I discuss the tax implications of the recent legislation, Tax Cuts and Job Acts, or TCJ for short, on the issue of alimony. On today's episode, Eric will not only address the impact TCJA had on the 75-year-old alimony provision, but he'll dive a little deeper into 7 other changes to the family law arena that are relevant to those not only going through the divorce process, but really beneficial to anyone filing taxes, which, my friend, is most of us. So in sharing a little bit about my guest today, Eric Rollinger is an attorney and partner in the Rockville, Maryland law firm of Stein, Sperling, Bennett, DeZong, Driscoll, PC. Eric is a certified public accountant, credentialed in valuation as a certified valuation analyst, and a master analyst in financial forensics by the National Association of Certified Valuators and Analysts. Eric has been honored many times for his excellence and contributions to both the legal and financial arenas, including an event I recently caught up with Eric where we were honored by the Washingtonian Magazine as one of the top lawyers in the Washington, D.C. area. So let's go ahead and get started because today's episode is chock full of really good, valuable information. Eric, I'd like to welcome you to the show today. Thank you so much for joining us today. Before we get started, I would like it if you could please just introduce yourself to my listeners and sort of talk a little bit about what you do.
Thanks for having me, Tracy. My name's Eric Rollinger, and I'm a tax attorney at the law firm of Stein Sperling. And I mostly do tax controversy work and also litigation support work, primarily in a divorce setting.
And Eric, you are also an attorney, correct? Is that right?
Correct. I'm an attorney and a CPA.
Wonderful. So you've got a lot of credentials behind your experience. And so I'm excited to talk to about today's topic, Eric, because as many people may be familiar with, there was a passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And I did a really short episode a couple of weeks back focusing on the change to the alimony provisions. However, what I'm excited to talk with you about today, that alimony isn't necessarily the only provision that was affected by this new tax cut, but rather there's some other areas as applicable to family law that we can get into today. Is that correct?
Very true. Alimony is the one that everyone seemed to talk about, and rightfully so, because it was a big change affecting the marital disillusion world. But there were many other changes that were part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which we commonly refer to by its acronym, TCJA.
And so can we, although, as I said, I did a little episode the other day, but I certainly did not give it the justice that I know you're going to give it for my listeners today. So can we start with the change that took place for alimony?
Yes. And like you pointed out, that is the probably the biggest change that affects the marital world. So if we start there, it's probably a good choice.
Okay.
I guess the biggest change was that alimony, which had previously been deductible by the payor and income to the recipient, now for agreements executed after 12/31/18, so now about 2 months and 5 days ago, now that treatment has switched, where for those who are in the family law world, it would be more similar to child support, where it's not deductible by the payor, and it's not income to the recipient.
And so that change took effect as of the beginning of this year, 2019?
Correct. And that was actually the only change from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, or at least the only change we'll probably talk about today, which took effect 1/1/19, so earlier this year. Most of the other changes of the TCJA took effect 1/1/18, at least the changes affecting individuals and businesses.
So Eric, as you and I both know, one of the key components when people are trying to settle that they try to come up with is a workable marriage settlement agreement. And so as part of a settlement agreement, a lot of times people on either side, depending if you're the recipient or the payor, sort of use alimony to some extent as leverage. Are you finding or do you have any thoughts on with this new passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act? Is that going to impact people's ability to sort of reach a resolution if it's no longer deductible by the payor?
I do think so. And sadly, as much as one might think, well, this won't have much of an effect because it's just become non-taxable to both parties. In practice, the way you laid it out is correct. There was a benefit that could hopefully be shared by both parties or used to reach an agreement where there was a benefit to what's usually the higher earning income spouse paying the lower earning income spouse because of marginal tax rates, where for most taxpayers in the United States, the higher your taxable income, the higher your marginal tax rate. So if you have one person now in 2019 at a 37% tax rate, and you have another person in, say, a 10% tax rate, well, there's a 27% savings on those dollars, which no longer exists starting 1/1/19 for agreements executed after 12/31/18. So yes, I think it does have an effect, and it can be fairly significant.
And so, Eric, in terms of agreements that occurred before the conclusion of the of 2018, are those impacted by this new tax cut?
No, luckily those are still grandfathered in, for lack of a better term. I'll use the term grandfathered, and they follow the old law, and it's public law 115-97 was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And there's a section which is directly on point, which says that agreements which were in existence or agreements which are modified can still follow the old law, which is a very nice thing for people who were able to get divorces executed and finalized or marital settlement agreements executed and finalized by 12/31/18. They actually not only get the still have this benefit that we discussed earlier, where the higher earning spouse is usually getting a greater benefit tax-wise from the lower earning spouse picking it up. This benefit can still exist in 2019 and future years, and can actually even be modified in the event that there's a material change in circumstances in Maryland, as our typical standard that we use for when people try to get these things modified. If you get it modified, even the modified agreement can still have this benefit, which no longer exists for those who have agreements executed after 12/31/18.
So as long as you were able to get the marriage agreement executed by the end of 2018, even if, say, 2-3 years down the road, and this new tax act has sort of taken effect, which takes away that benefit, that modification is still subject to the terms and provisions of the 2018 agreement.
Correct. Unless you specifically state in the new agreement, you want the new law to apply. So you even have the best of both worlds. You can choose whether you want it to apply or not. So you have only upside and no downside.
You can say
that we want the new law, which in the situations we were describing wouldn't normally be a situation you would want. But perhaps if for some reason the paying spouse has lower taxable income than the recipient spouse for a certain period of time, then you might actually want the new law, and you can choose to have the new law apply if you so state in the modified agreement.
So let's talk a little bit about what alimony payments are, Eric. Can you walk us through that?
Yes, and you have to be very careful, because assuming you were able to have an agreement executed prior to 12/31/18, alimony is still a defined term in the Internal Revenue Code. And for those who are in this world, and I'm a bit of a numbers guy, so I use a lot of code sections, it's Internal Revenue Code Section 71, and to a lesser extent, Section 215. But basically, for something to be alimony, it must be in cash, and it must be paid to the former spouse or on their behalf. So you can make the car payment for the former spouse directly to the car dealership, Honda Financing, and still have that be considered a cash payment on their behalf and still qualify. But it has to be to them or on their behalf. You can't have it be designated as a type of payment that's not alimony, which is always strange language. It's a double negative language. So you kind of have the presumption that it is alimony as long as the agreement says that it's not meant not to be alimony. One of the other criteria is that you can't make payments to a member, the recipient, while you're members of the same household, or if you're doing a married filing joint return. The married filing joint return is perhaps a bit more obvious. How would you deduct it and include it as income on the same return? You'd have no benefit from that. So you can't do that. You also must have in the agreement that the payments stop upon the death of the recipient. And these are all of the criteria which are laid out in Internal Revenue Code Section 71. Those are the main five, and there are others, but those are the main ones that we see. Luckily, under Maryland law, which is where I believe you practice, Tracy, mostly, and where I practice mostly, we actually have a default law in Maryland, which says that there's an assumption that the payments will stop upon the death of the recipient. So if any of our drafters of language leave that out, luckily in Maryland, we're okay. There have been cases in other states, and I think Florida is one that comes to mind, where the drafters, usually the family law lawyers, left this out. And it was deemed not to be alimony because you're not meeting all the requirements, which is it must stop upon the death of the recipient. So you have to be careful if you are executing these agreements or you're thinking you're going to be able to take this alimony deduction. if you miss one of these elements, the IRS is not going to allow it because you haven't met the definition under the Internal Revenue Code.
And so I just want to, just for my listeners, because I can sometimes be very literal, but in terms of payments in cash, you're not saying, Eric, that people have to make actual payments in the form of cash. It can be a check. It can be a bank transfer. It can be, as you already described, a payment on behalf of that other person.
You're correct. If you want to make the payments via Venmo, or you don't even write checks nowadays, oftentimes, it doesn't have to be the old dollar bills changing hands. Payments in cash can be credit cards, checks, you name it, any form of payment that's basically in, if you're in the United States, say anything that's in U.S. dollars.
Anything in U.S. dollars.
And it doesn't even need to be in U.S. dollars if you were, say, paying it overseas and there's an exchange that needs to be made. As long as you're making the payments, they are acceptable.
Okay. And so one of the other things in terms of what we just discussed is writing instruments and sort of what that looks like in terms of where these terms of alimony are spelled out. Can you talk about what qualifies as a written instrument, where alimony provisions would be detailed?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the criteria of alimony, which I think I mentioned, but I might have forgot, is it must be pursuant to a written instrument. And that is extremely important. If it's not, it isn't going to qualify. And for something to be a written instrument, and again, we go back to the Internal Revenue Code, because a lot of this is statutory, we have to go to Section 71, Subsection B, which defines what a written instrument is. And written instruments are, in layman's terms, basically divorce decrees, marital settlement agreements, or agreements incident to a divorce. And that's the most common definition of what is a written instrument. But it has been interpreted a little bit more broadly by the U.S. Tax Court.
In what way?
The U.S. Tax Court's been pretty liberal in that they've said that a written instrument doesn't necessarily need to satisfy particular formal requirements, where they've allowed in the past where there's been an oral agreement between two divorcing parties, and then it was put into an email later, which said, pursuant to our agreement, I'm going to pay. And I believe in that case, it was for healthcare for the former spouse or the soon-to-be former spouse. And the tax court said, you know what, even it's in an email, and even though you reference an oral agreement, we're going to allow that. We're going to say that that email was good enough to be a written instrument. And actually, I use the term email, but this case was, I believe, actually from like 1982, an email didn't exist, where I believe it was a written letter. And the courts have been pretty accepting of letters between husband and wife, they're saying, or ex-husband and wife, soon to be, they're saying that this is qualified as a written instrument because it's written down. And I suspect that an email would be treated the same way as a letter, which means, especially if you're a family law attorney, or you're someone who's going to be going through a divorce, you better be very careful about your exchanges with your soon-to-be former ex-spouse, because next thing you know, you've got what they consider to be a written instrument. And that's something that the tax court has been willing to accept as a written instrument, even though it might not meet the typical four corners of a document language that all the lawyers learned in law school. So it's something to be very careful about, and probably not a good idea to be exchanging written communications with your soon-to-be ex-spouse if you're going through a divorce.
And I couldn't agree more, because so much of my clients, and I'm sure your client communications are electronic, whether it be an email or text messages. And I was chuckling a little bit because I'm like, a letter? What on earth is a letter? I can't even remember the last time I've written somebody a letter. So, but you're absolutely correct in terms of, you've really got to be mindful of what you say and what you capture in writing these days. So one of the other things I want to ask you about is, so we were talking about written instruments, you mentioned obviously court orders, marital separation agreements, emails and letters and text messages. But what about agreements that have language in them that were either a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement? Do those qualify also as written instruments?
It's a great question. I am of the opinion that the answer is very, very likely no. And it's a question that I get asked a lot. And the reason I answer very, very likely no is there is a treasury reg, which for those who aren't familiar with treasury regs, they have the full force and effect of law if they're final or temporary. There's also a third kind called proposed regs. But there's a final treasury reg, which is, and I'm a big numbers guy, so I'm good at memorizing numbers. If you look at treasury reg 1.71-1B6, they have an example, and it's example number 2. And it's the only place in the statute or the final regs, which are the law, which even uses the term nuptial agreement. And so it's only in one spot, but what the Treasury reg says is that a nuptial agreement does not qualify as a written instrument that can be later, say, modified so that you could hopefully make the argument, well, I have a prenup or a postnup that was executed prior to 12/31/18. And now, even though the actual divorce is happening in 2022, we're going to use that so that the higher earning spouse can deduct alimony payments as laid out in the prenuptial agreement, given this treasury reg. And there's also some case law. And the two that I'm most familiar with is one case out of New York and one case out of Richmond, Virginia, where the state courts have also said that they don't view prenuptial agreements as written separation agreements that would qualify as executed agreements prior to 12/31/18. So given this treasury reg and some of the state rulings on this point, I'm of the opinion that it's very likely no. I am aware of some other practitioners and experts who are not as confident, and they think there's maybe some latitude in this where there's perhaps a small open window that it could be used and there could be some legal basis because these were all decided prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act becoming law on December 22nd of 2017. But in my opinion, I would say it's very likely no.
And I would say, and I think you'd probably agree with me, Eric, that this is, if you think that this may be your case or you have some questions about this, that people should really seek the advice of counsel in their jurisdiction to help them determine whether or not it is likely no, or there may be some circumstances in which it can be.
Agreed. And if you were going to try to make the argument, the circumstance where you might have the best chance would be if your prenuptial agreement was very clear and said that the payments are going to be in cash. They're going to be for this amount of, pick your number, $10,000 per month, whatever the number is, for this length of time. It's going to end upon the death of the recipient. So we'd at least have all the requirements that you need under Internal Revenue Code Section 71. Because if you don't even have those things, then you're exactly right. You should seek the advice of a professional, but they would almost certainly tell you that in that situation, you probably lose under two different grounds. Whereas if you have all the criteria and it is in your nuptial agreement, then perhaps you at least want to check with a professional to see if there is some chance that this could work, because the tax savings can be significant.
So moving from alimony, there was a period of time in which attorney's fees were also tax deductible. Is that still the case today?
No, sadly, no. And that was something where attorney's fees prior to January 1st of 2018, because now we've moved from alimony to itemized deductions, which, like most of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act changes, became effective January 1 of 18. So people who are doing their taxes now for the 2018 tax year are going to start to see the effects now when they're trying to file their taxes. And one of those effects would be if they've been having a long divorce with you, Tracy, which some of these divorces can last well over a year.
Yes, they
can. And they're used to, in 2017 tax returns, say your legal fees for 2017, which they paid during that year, were $10,000. And they were used to deducting that $10,000 on their 17 return. Well, now if they have that same $10,000 worth of fees, which they paid in 18, they no longer get the deduction. And that's also the same for experts, similar to myself, and for your tax professionals who say, prepare your tax return. All of these itemized deductions that at least were subject to 2% of your adjusted gross income, they're all eliminated for the years 2018 through 2025. So that includes any of your fees, any of my fees, any of their tax professional fees, any of those fees, even if they were for tax advice, if they were to obtain alimony or obtain child support or to discuss what their after-tax income would be in the event, considering if they should accept a settlement agreement, all these items that used to be deductible are no longer deductible, at least for the years of 2018 through 2025.
And so, Eric, I'm curious. So in 2025, when the expiration of this current tax cut expires, what happens under those circumstances? Does it revert back to what the prior law was prior to 2018, or is it revised and something else will take effect?
As it currently stands, it'll go back to what the law was as of 12/31/2017. So that was the law that we're the most familiar with because that's been most of our filing seasons. So it does revert back to what the law was prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act being enacted.
Okay. And so you did mention standardized deductions. Can you talk a little bit more about how that has been impacted by this new tax cut?
Yes. The standard deduction, which is for those people who don't itemize, which in Maryland, we were the highest itemizing state. So when we did away with these itemized deductions that we were just talking about, and there were some other changes to itemized deductions also, the biggest one being that you can't deduct your state and local income taxes, which was one of the main reasons why Maryland was the top state at about 50% as of the most recent data, 2016, I believe, was the most recent year. People then, if they don't itemize, they take what's called the standard deduction. And under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they took away a lot of itemized deductions, but they also gave a higher standard deduction. So it almost doubled for pretty much every filing status, slightly less than doubled, where if you were a single filer in 2017, for example, your standard deduction was about $6,350. For 2018, it'll be $12,000. And if you were married filing joint, you just double those numbers. And if you're head of household, it's about 150% of those numbers. So they have taken the itemized deductions, which is bad for most people in the state of Maryland, but they did make the standard deduction higher, which does away with some of the hit from losing some of your itemized deductions.
And so what about in terms of, and just sticking with, because this is so timely in terms of tax season, what about personal and dependency exemptions? Have those been altered at all with this new tax cut?
Yes. And that's another big, big change of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is that you are absolutely correct that for 2018 through 2025, the personal exemption and the dependency exemption are now zero. So to give people an idea, in 2017, the personal exemption and the dependency exemption for all your dependents was $4,050 per person. Now it's zero. So this is another item that's being taken away by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which will likely result at least on this one issue, in people having a higher tax burden at the end of the year because you've lost this $4,050. For lack of a better term, it's actually an exemption, but I like to call it similar to an off-the-top deduction, which you no longer have for the years of 18 through 25.
And so for, and through the 18 and 25, again, that then will revert back to what it is right now, presumably.
Correct. For this item, we do have something called a cost of living adjustment, commonly referred to as COLA for the acronym. And I believe that for the dependency exemption, and similar to actually for the itemized deductions also, actually it would be more the standard deduction also, even though they're lower, they are adjusted for cost of living. And I do believe that it would be higher than $4,050 in 2026 when you get this again, because it'll be the equivalent of what $4,050 was worth in 2017. Whatever that equivalent is in 2026, that will be, at least under current law, if nothing changes, what someone would get as their dependency or personal exemption in 2026.
And so in talking about the dependency exemption, Eric, can you talk a little bit about what that actually looks like for parties in divorce households, particularly when you have the scenario when children are living with one parent more time or more nights than with another parent, or it's close in terms of a shared custody schedule? Does that impact the dependency exemption and who gets to take it?
Yes, very much. And that's a very contentious issue, which I see in most of the divorce cases that I am brought in as an expert or as a tax consultant, where that comes up continually, where we see these marital settlement agreements, which say joint 50-50 custody. And then the question becomes, well, it's joint 50-50, and there's been no agreement in the marital settlement agreement. This obviously isn't an agreement written by you, Tracy. It's written by some other people who haven't thought of this. And then we have the issue of, well, who gets to claim the dependency exemption for, say, these four children? And that can add up quickly. If you have over $16,000 of dependency exemptions for the 17-year, $16,200, you want to get that benefit, but so does the other party, probably. So then there becomes a race to file the tax return first and to claim the kids as your dependents. And the way the IRS looks at it is they actually say in the instructions to the Form 1040, whoever has the children more nights during the year is the person who's able to claim the dependency exemptions if there's a lack of any agreement, which is typically a Form 8332 saying that one party gets to claim it and the other doesn't. What's interesting, though, is even though that's what the instructions to the 1040 say, that's not what the law says. People oftentimes think the instructions to these IRS forms are the law, which they're not. They are an IRS person's interpretation of the law written in a format that they think is easy for lay people to understand. But the statute says whoever is the custodial parent, and custodial parent is defined as more time. Well, there is a great tax court case, and it's one that I cite often, which is Frank Planko v. Commissioner. And what that case said was that even though one parent had the children 183 nights, and the other parent had the child 182 nights, and there was no agreement, so there was no 8332 between these two parties saying that one person gets to claim them and one person doesn't. The tax court said that because you both claim the children as dependents, we don't care that we acknowledge one person with 183 nights per the instructions could claim the dependency exemption. The law is whoever had a more time. And the gentleman in this case is the one who had the 182 hours. He took the time to actually go through every hour of the entire year. And I believe this case was from 2003. And I believe the year at issue was like 2000 or 2001. So he went through the entire year, mapped out every single hour that the children were with him, every hour the children were with his ex-spouse, and every hour they were with neither. And he could show that he had about 20 more hours or 40 more hours than his spouse did. And the court said, okay, you get to claim it, even though you had less nights. So it's very important to know who has the children more time during the year.
That's incredible. So it was actually the hour, the minutes on the clock that mattered in this case, and not simply where they spent the night.
Correct. And I will say that there is a case which just came out in the last few months, actually came out of Maryland, and a case out of Maryland, which also went to the U.S. tax court, which ironically did not even reference this Planko case, but they kind of walked it back a little bit. And this is very new. This is just in the last few months, where the tax court in this more recent case, again, not even referencing Planko. So Planko is still good law. If you shepherdize it, there's not even any yellow flag that comes up. But there is a new tax court case which said that it was too impractical for the years at issue to determine the number of hours. So they did let the person who had more nights out of the year claim the children as dependents for lack of any better information.
You know, so I was just thinking about when you said that before, I don't mean to interrupt, because in terms of being able to support the number of hours he had the kids versus when he didn't, I don't know if the other side in this Planko case simply didn't do the work and there was nothing to refute, but or rebut the presumption that he had more time. But I'm surprised by that. That's amazing.
Agreed. And the tax court in the last few months agreed with you, which said that this is impractical. It wasn't done at the time. We think it's too hard to be sure what is or is not to the minute. We're going with the person who can show that they had him 183 nights pursuant to the agreement, and that's that. That situation was kind of your typical alternating weekend type schedule, where then just using the marital settlement agreement, the court said one person has one or two more nights, and we're going with that.
Okay. And so in using this, the form, the 8332 form, so is that still the right form to use if parents have an agreement to alternate the dependency?
Yes. And that was a big question with we obviously up till 2017, we always wanted the 8332 because it made a big difference. We knew there was a dependency exemption and we knew it was $4,000 per child, as long as you weren't phased out, which there were some phase outs. So sometimes even the higher income earning spouse didn't actually want it. You wanted the lower income earning spouse to have it because of the phase outs. But getting over the phase outs and just going to the potential benefits, that was a really good question was, are we still going to have a Form 8332 in 2018 through 2025 because the exemption is zero? So what's the benefit? Well, the answer is it still does exist. The IRS just revised the form in October of 2018, and it made it very clear, they meaning the Internal Revenue Service, that this form can still be used and still should be used in situations where the non-custodial parent wants to have the custodial parent be the other party, at least for purposes of the dependency exemption, which is now zero, but also for the child tax credit. And that is a big number potentially, depending on the number of children and if you qualify and you're not phased out. So it does still have value and it still should be used.
So that's a great segue, Eric. Can we move towards the child tax credit and talk a little bit about what that is and how that was impacted?
Yes. The child tax credit was another gift or a benefit of the TCJA. Similar to the standard deduction, the child tax credit was increased and basically doubled, where now the child tax credit is $2,000 per qualifying child for the years of 2018 through 2025. For those who remember taking the child tax credit on their 16 and 17 returns or previous years, it was only $1,000 per child. And credits are very good things. Whenever I'm talking to taxpayers, I always say there are four very good benefits you can have under the Internal Revenue Code, the very best of which is a refundable tax credit. The second is a non-refundable credit. The third is an off-the-top deduction. The fourth is an itemized deduction. Well, the child tax credit is a non-refundable credit for $2,000 per child, and a $1,400 of that $2,000 is a refundable credit per child. So this is an extremely beneficial credit to have. And the reason why credits are better than deductions is it's a dollar for dollar reduction of your tax owed. So if you had $100,000 of income and you owe $20,000 of federal income tax, and you have two children, and now you have a $4,000 refundable credit, well, now instead of owing $20,000, you only owe $16,000. So it reduced it dollar for dollar by $2,000 per child, which can add up very quickly, obviously, if you have multiple children.
And Eric, does this credit apply across the board? And what I mean by that is for parties who are filing, say, married filing jointly or married filing separately or head of household, is it across the board that anybody can obtain this credit?
Yes. Now, it is across the board. It is $2,000 credit per child. But there are phase outs again. And I used that term earlier without explaining it, where a phase out is just like it sounds. And for the child tax credit, if you're a married filing joint taxpayer, it phases out between $400,000 and $440,000 of income. So if your income is over $440,000, the credit for you actually becomes zero. It's $2,000 per child if you have $399,000 of income, but it's actually zero if you have $441,000 of income for married filing joint. For head of household, married filing separate and single, it's $200,000 to $240,000 is where the phase out comes into effect. So it's for all filing statuses, but there's higher phase outs if you're married filing joint versus the other filing statuses.
Now, for similarly to what qualified as a written instrument when we were discussing alimony, what qualifies, what's a qualifying child, I should say, for purposes of the child tax credit?
I'm glad you asked that because that's a very good point. People oftentimes think, oh, My child is in college and a full-time student and they live with me. And that child could still be a dependent and qualify as a dependent on your tax return. And when the dependency exemption was more than zero, that would mean something as long as they were under age 24 as of the last day of the year. The qualifying child tax credit to be a qualifying child, the child must be 17 years old or under as of 12/31/18 if you're doing your 2018 taxes. So your child cannot be 18 years or older as of the last day of the year and still be able to claim the child tax credit. Additionally, you must bear a relationship to that child. It has to be someone who is a descendant of you, or a stepbrother or a stepsister would also qualify, as well as a brother or sister. So bear a relationship is the language that is used, which has been expanded to say you were the oldest child and sadly your parents were deceased. And now you're taking care of, say, the youngest child who's your younger brother or sister. In that situation, you could still qualify for the child tax credit as long as your brother or sister who you're taking care of, meaning you provide the principal place of abode for that brother or sister. They live in your home more than half the year. they don't provide over half of their own support, and they're under the age of 17, you could then also claim your brother, sister, or any person who you bear a relationship to, which usually means your own children or your direct relatives, meaning you could also claim if you had, say, a grandchild who was also under the age of 17, that could also qualify if you met the other standards.
So I think it's really important to highlight, which you already did, that for purposes of the child tax credit, it is not necessarily tied to payments of child support, but rather the actual child's age. Because as you and I know, in some jurisdictions like DC, for example, the parents pay child support up and through the child could be 21 years of age. So, but this, for purposes of the child tax credit, it simply is 17 years old across the board, regardless of what jurisdiction you're in and regardless of what the child support laws are in your jurisdiction.
That is exactly right. And I do like the DC example where you're correct. In DC, it's up to age 21. In Maryland, age 18 or under 19 if not graduated high school. The Internal Revenue Service or the Internal Revenue Code, which the Internal Revenue Service is interpreting, does not use those dates. They use 17, which is just like you said.
So in moving away from children and sort of the effects on individual families, what about homes and properties? Has the Tax Cut and Jobs Act affected, interest on homes?
Yes, and that was one of the other big changes of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which a lot of people, especially if they live in higher cost areas, which I think the DC suburbs, which is where you and I are in Montgomery County. Montgomery County is one of the wealthiest counties in the United States, and it has very high property values. So when people are acquiring homes in the Montgomery County area and some of these other wealthy counties in the DC area, say Loudoun County in Virginia, or some of the other DC metropolitan areas, some of these homes are very expensive. And it used to be under the old law that you could have up to $1 million of home acquisition costs. And then when you paid the interest on it, that was a deduction. Well, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act said, we're going to change that $1 million and we're going to make it $750,000. Luckily for people who had already bought their homes, who have more than $750,000 of mortgage or home acquisition indebtedness, those people, again, for lack of a better term, are grandfathered in. They can still deduct their interest expense up to the full $1 million, which the law used to be. But anyone since March 31st of 2018, any closings after that date, if you bought a $1 million home in Bethesda or Potomac or Chevy Chase or any of these expensive areas in the DC area, and if you spent $1.2 million on your home and you had to finance $1 million of it via a mortgage and a home equity line of credit, whatever you had to do, and you have that $1 million mortgage or mortgages, you can only deduct $750,000 out of the million of the interest that you pay on that home. So for those people, under the simple math example I gave, if they had $50,000 of home mortgage interest, which they might get on their form 1098, which is what shows your home mortgage interest, and they give it to their tax preparer, if their tax preparer is smart, or if she is smart, she is going to say to the taxpayers, hold on, you bought this house after March 31st, 2018, you only get to take 3/4 of this interest, which would be $750,000 divided by $1 million. And those taxpayers who now have over $750,000 of home acquisition indebtedness are sadly losing out on this interest expense, which can be very big numbers.
Absolutely. In this area, you are very correct in terms of what the cost of properties are in the DC metro area. And so in similarly thinking, what about home equity interest in terms of, you know, you have your home and then you take out a loan of some sort in order to make renovations or repairs? Has that been impacted as well?
Yes. And it's something that I should mention as part of the home acquisition discussion. I'm glad you brought it up, which is that in addition to home acquisition indebtedness, which is just as it sounds, what you use to acquire the home, there's also something called home equity indebtedness. And there used to be, again, prior to 1/1/18, you used to be able to deduct the interest on up to $100,000 of home equity indebtedness, which you could actually use the $100,000 for anything you wanted. You could actually use it to pay Tracy Coates' marital legal fees and still deduct the interest as long as it was the collateral was your home. You had this ability to deduct interest on a home equity line of credit, which would commonly be called a HELOC, is the most common, where you used your house as the collateral. And the law has been changed with the TCJA to say that this is no longer the case. And that actually, we've been talking about all these other law changes which were grandfathered in. This one was not grandfathered. So this was even worse. And this one potentially has what we call a retroactive effect, which is something the legislators usually try to avoid. But I'll give you an example of a person who perhaps lives in one of these expensive neighborhoods, let's just say Bethesda, and they bought their house in, he or she or they bought their house in 2015 for $1.1 million of financing. And they were thinking, or he or she, that I'm going to be okay because I can deduct the interest on this $1.1 million. I can use $1 million for home acquisition indebtedness, and I also have another $100,000 of home equity indebtedness because the collateral for these loans is my house. And the ability to deduct all of that interest was available to them in 15, 16, 17, but now they're coming to 18. For this year, they can no longer deduct 1/11th of their interest. Because under that simple example, $100,000 of that $1.1 million is no longer allowed. And that one became retroactively effective, which means that even though they did it prior to the law change, or prior to anyone even thinking the law was going to change, the law did change and it retroactively affects them at least for the years going forward, which perhaps retroactive is not the best term because they don't have to change the 15, 16, and 17 returns. But they are no longer able to claim it for 2018 through 2025.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure I understood that the retroactivity. So they don't have to change what they previously were able to deduct. There's no payments owed, but just going forward through this specified period of time through 2025, that has been taken away.
You are correct. So you're right. Using the term retroactive is not exactly accurate because it would be you'd have to perhaps retroactively amend your tax returns. I guess I use it from the perspective of retroactively that it affected something you did in the past and which you thought you're going to have a benefit, which now you don't. So you are correct. You do not have to retroactively amend your tax returns for the years in which that was the law. You just don't get the benefit in the current year and the future years through 2025.
Okay. And so one of the other topics, one of the final topics that I want you to share with my audience today has to do with 529 plans. Can you talk about how 529 plans, first of all, what they are, and then how they were impacted as well by this new tax cut?
Yes, this is for the 529 plans. And to take a step back for those who don't know what 529 plans are, they're referring to Internal Revenue Code Section 529. And what 529 said is that if you, as a taxpayer, want to invest in what at prior to 1/1/18 was only college education savings, that we are going to give you a tax-free vehicle for doing it. You have to put in after-tax dollars. But once you put those after-tax dollars into a 529 plan, which are run by the states, so you have to go through a state which has a 529 plan, which most of them do, and you put the money into that 529 plan, the growth of the income in that 529 plan will not be taxable as it's growing. And when you take it out, as long as you use it for qualified education expenses, you won't pay income taxes then either, which is a big double benefit. So if you think about it, and let's say you put in $10,000 into a 529 plan this year, and that $10,000 ends up being worth $11,000 at the end of 2019. Well, typically, if you just had money in, say, IBM, and you put $10,000 in IBM, and then it's worth $11,000, you would, in theory, have $1,000 of capital gains, especially if you sold the IBM stock. And you have to pay capital gains on that $1,000. Well, what they've said under a 529 plan is, no, do not worry about that. We're going to let you not pay any capital gains taxes as you go on the appreciation of value. And when you take the money out, as long as it's used for education expenses, which now starting in 2018 can even be elementary or secondary secular and religious elementary school education,
which
as well
huge,
as college.
Which I yes. think personally is huge.
Agreed. They're going to say, okay, you don't have to pay income tax on that or any type of taxes. You got the growth and you never have to pay the tax on it. And that is big. And that was the change, which is that it used to be only for college. And now they changed the law starting in 2018 that you can use it for elementary or secondary education for public or private, secular or religious schools.
And are there any nuances, Eric, in terms of out-of-pocket expenses? I can't seem to talk today. Out-of-pocket expenses that are deductible or maybe deductible?
Yes, there is. And one of the big benefits which we should talk about on this is out-of-pocket school expenses may be deductible if state law defines it as a homeschool, as a type of private school. If they don't, homeschooling and like some of your out-of-pocket expenses will not qualify. And then if you take money out of a 529 plan and you don't use it for qualified education, then you do have to pay the income tax on it and you have to pay a 10% penalty. And something else that's really important with 529 plans is that it's not just at the federal level where you have this benefit of you get tax-free growth and then no tax when you take it out. Most of the states and every state which has a plan that I'm aware of follows the feds and says that we're not going to make you pay income tax either. And a lot of states, Maryland being one of them, says on top of that, we're also going to let you claim an off-the-top deduction on your tax return. So we'll make it so that you even get a tax benefit when you put the money in. So we're going to give you all the benefits that the Internal Revenue Service did, and we're going to give you another benefit, which in Maryland is up to $2,500 per beneficiary per year. So if you have two children and you're married, you actually each taxpayer, so up to $5,000 per beneficiary per year. So you can, in theory, put $10,000 into your children's 529s plans if you had two of them, get a $10,000 off-the-top deduction on your Maryland tax return. And in addition to that, when you take the money out, there is no growth on it and you pay no income tax. Extreme benefit at the state level. Extreme.
Absolutely. And I know that you mentioned Maryland, Eric, but how would people who are not residents of Maryland find out if their state also offered similar benefits?
There's actually some great sites. And I was, in preparation for this speech, actually looking at one of them earlier today. And Merrill Lynch, or Merrill Edge now, has a great site, which I'm trying to find as I do a quick Google search. And it did a great job of laying out what states have 529 plans and what amount you're allowed to deduct on your state tax return. And I will try to find that link and send it to you, Tracy.
Oh, that would
be
great.
So that you have it.
And I can put it in the show notes, too. So if you can't find it now, and afterwards, you can send it to me, and I'll make sure that I include it in the show notes for people to access. But
perfect.
Eric,
I will find and send.
That would be wonderful. And I know, Eric, that I can certainly speak on behalf of my listeners today. I cannot believe we are out of time, but this has been so truly valuable. And I am very appreciative of you coming on and sharing your knowledge. And the other thing that we didn't even mention at the beginning of the podcast is that you are our first male guest. And so that is another woohoo. Thank you for coming on and joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. And I am excited to be the first male guest. Hopefully I will not be the only male guest.
No. But you set the bar.
Well, I was glad to do it. Thanks for having me. And I look forward to listening to the podcast and getting this really nice document over to you, which will lay out every state's 529 plans and the amount that each state allows you to deduct on their respective income tax returns.
That would be great. Eric Rollinger, thank you so much for joining me on today's podcast. And thank you.
Thanks again.
Well, that was a really great episode today. And another big thank you to my guest, Eric Rollinger, for all of his valuable insight that he provided. And as always, thank you so much for joining me today. And don't forget to download 10 mistakes to avoid during a divorce at thedivorcechronicles.com/checklist and the post-divorce financial checklist at thedivorcechronicles.com/11. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please don't be shy and head over to iTunes and leave me a review. And thank you to everyone who has already taken the time to do so. I really appreciate it. If you have any ideas that you'd like to hear or share yourself on upcoming episodes, please feel free to send me an email at tracy@thedivorcechronicles.com. Or as always, simply say hello. Well, until next time.
Thank you for listening to The Divorce Chronicles at www.thedivorcechronicles.com. Don't forget to join us next time for another great episode.